convention, that Tonga is not managing anymore because he was a chef, and now it's fine. If you have any things you want to talk about from the managing point of view, this is just to move this way now. Have a escort. Is that clear? Okay, so this evening, I want to talk of a possibly not so simple subject, but I might do it simply. I want to talk about awakening, enlightenment. And first to say the word itself, personally I prefer to use awakening, because enlightenment, I think, is a whole kind of images and ideas. And often we have the feeling that with enlightenment, we get very, yes, I want it. Enlightenment, you know, I'm going to flop, very up for my cousin, in so little. Then I'm going to lit up, a bit like a Christmas tree. And often there is a feeling that, and then I will be totally perfect, and then I will be totally sorted. I will not have any problem in my life anymore. Let it be like a magic wand. And then, of course, everybody wants this. It should be nice, but unfortunately, I'm not sure this was a good act he's talking about. That's why I would prefer to use the word awakening, which has lost of all these associations, which might not be so necessary, but I think we should be waiting for something which actually might not be the way we imagine it to be. And that way, to be careful of the difference with what I would call inspiration and expectation. Often I think that when we sit in meditation, we expect something to happen. We want to be different. We want not to have this. We want to have that. And I think that actually fixes us and also gives us some tension sometimes, because we don't get it. So we get frustrated. I'm supposed to sit and get this, and it's not working. Something wrong with me. Something wrong with the practice. And I prefer to look at inspiration that we sit in meditation, not because we have nothing better to do. I think we sit in meditation because we are inspired to sit in meditation. We're inspired by whatever kind of something we do in our life. We give meaning, we give value. For myself, it would be wisdom and compassion. For others, it might be something else. But we're inspired by something. And by being inspired, then we give us energy. And also, it is open, because we don't aspire to something very definite. But we aspire to a movement, an opening within ourselves. So to be careful, often with awakening, often there is this actual expectation. And it seems to me the movement is of aspiration. Then, first I'd like to look at different experiences in meditation that we can have and that often we associate with awakening. And first, we have what I would call meditative state. We sit in meditation, and generally, we will experience what I would call a meditative state, when we are feeling very calm, very clear. And it's interesting, when we experience this, at the beginning we get very excited, next minute, I am awakened, you know. Then I can become a guru and get lots of Rolls Royce, or whatever. But you see, as soon as we get excited, we go. And so in a way, we need to learn to be in this meditative state, just to embrace them, just to be with them, just to, in a way, be nurtured by that quietness, by that clarity. But I think that quietness and clarity appear because of the moment of digressing. That's what I think, meditative state happens because there's been some the looting, the grasping, in whatever manner. We might also have an experience, and this has been a very beautiful moment in the meditation, when suddenly our heart opens. And the way I would describe it is that suddenly we experience that we have no problem with nobody. I mean, that's where we, our heart is open to everyone. We do not make any discrimination. Our heart is just open to ourselves, to the world. Or we might have experienced in different ways of emptiness. This is also true, this experience of emptiness. We might experience that our body is not so solid, or many different ways we can experience emptiness in meditation. And then again we get very excited, or we get very worried. I am empty. And then we also get, don't worry, you're still there. You know, you're not liquefied in a puddle or something, you're still there. But again, it's an experience of relief, of de-grasping. So of course we feel differently when we normally feel, but generally we intentionally feel like this. When we feel that feeling of emptiness, it's because we're not so rigid anymore. There is no flow in the whole being. Then there is what I would call the experience of insight. Now, I've already talked a little about that. Well, this can be in meditation or not, but suddenly, experientially, you see something you've never seen before. It's really clear. You really see it. And in a way, you cannot not know it after that. You know something you do not know before. You really know this. You really have experienced it. But in a way, often it's just a flash. And then there is, it becomes more like a memory. And it's very much the question is, how can I integrate this in my daily life? How can this make a difference to the way I look at the world, to the way I relate to others? So this is in a way, with inside, the great thing. How can it not stay on the meditation cushion in the past, but how can I bring it, how can I make it organic in my daily life? Then there is mystical state. And that, people really love those. Really, really wonderful. They're very exciting, lots of energy, and you think, ah! You know, you think, wow! You know, and it's quite intense, actually. And it can be about many different things. You can suddenly have this mystical experience that everybody has a Buddha nature. You sit there and you know for yourself, everybody, every single person has a Buddha nature. Everybody has a potential for manifesting wisdom and compassion. And this is a wonderful thing to have, a wonderful experience. But again, it passes, not everything else. And then the challenge in a way that, again, it's become a memory, an experience, and how can I integrate this in my life? How can we make this organic so that you look differently at your bothersome neighbor? I mean, can you see your neighbor too having the Buddha nature? Or is it just the people on the retreat? I mean, this is, I think, the challenge with any mystical insight, that it doesn't remain just this intense, wonderful state, but it's something which percolates in the whole being and makes a difference to the way we grow, to the way we are. And so, at that level, I think we have to be careful to equate awakening with all these different experiences. I think they are part of the practice. But we have to remember that in a way, awakening comes from the three trainings. Effort, meditation, and wisdom. Awakening does not just come from meditation experience. It's a whole. It's a kind of a cultivation of a certain ethical way of life. It's a cultivation of meditation, of course, And it's also the cultivation of wisdom, of this experiential wisdom, which turns, in a way, we are to ourselves and to others. And this, in a way, makes us see that awakening doesn't just depend on one experience. But I think often that's what we see. Often that's also the way it's presented. In different traditions, it's presented at that way. But what we want is that experience. And then we'll be awakened and then, and we can stop. You know, maybe we can do something there. You know, now that we've got it, that experience. But I don't think this is the way it is. Once I lived in a community, and there was one person who became a community member, and he had been a monk, he had had amazing experience in Burma. He was incredibly learned. He had done all the sutra, he could really teach them in the most beautiful way. Really, really amazing sutra teacher. And also, and this is even worse, he had done lots of therapeutic work, psychology and everything. And he was impossible to live with. This, to me, teaches me something. That, in a way, we are multidimensional. And one experience is not going to totally kind of deal with all aspects of our multidimensional being. And often what we told ourselves, when we felt a bit better, we thought, well, if you have not done all these things, you would be worse. That's the way we kind of manage. But if I think of my teacher in Korea, Master Chidan, what was interesting with him is that he was reputed to have had three awakenings. And you would say, well, you know, one should be enough, you know. Give me one, I'm fine. But he got three. And what was interesting was the third time, because the way you go in Korea is that you have an experience and then you go to your teacher and you write a poem and then your teacher says, yes, you know, you have a good understanding or no, this is not it. So, you know, each time the teacher says, yes, yes, you know, you understood something. And the third time, the teacher said, now, you have experienced, you have understood more than I have. Until now, I was your teacher. Now, you will be my teacher. And again, it shows that there can be different awakenings, and it also shows the role of the teacher is in a way to make the disciple really greater than himself or herself. And that was my experience with Master Kuzan, my teacher, was that we would meditate all the time. And we would be, when we traveled, I traveled twice with him, and we'd be in buses, in planes, anywhere. Although he had had three awakenings, he would still meditate. You know, and he would cross his leg and he would say, hey, come on, you know, meditate. Now we're so tired, you know. But everywhere he would meditate. And it was a nice thing of his life. He meditated. And a few months before he died, I walked with him. We went walking, and then we stopped, and we sat down, and he said to me, you never know how you're going to be when you die. For this feeling, you have to meditate. And he said, me too. I don't know how I'm going to be when I die. So I have to meditate. And for me, this was a very humbling moment. But for him, the meditation was not something that you just stopped after one experience, but that it was something you continue, because there is always something more to learn, to understand, to release, to grasp. And for me, this is very important. In terms of awakening, in terms of the practice, not that we want to get an experience, but that it is a path, it is a way we walk upon, to try to work in different ways, with the whole multidimensionality of our being. And now I'd like to just first talk about a few symbols of the volcano, as it would be, for example, presented in Korea. Well, in Korea, if you do any ceremony, you will light a candle, you will offer some incense, and you will also offer some water. And you do this because this is a symbol of the volcano. And to me, this is very interesting because it says something about what is a volcano. And so for the candle, you lit the candle, and how is it a symbol of awakening? Because actually, it demonstrates selflessness. Because as the candles disappear, it gives light. So in a way, as it consumes itself, it gives light. But when the candle is lit, two things happen. The candle itself is illuminated, but also it is illuminating to everyone who is around the candle. And I think in a way this is a function of the awakening. That ourselves, we are illuminating, but also we are illuminating for others. But at the same time, there is that experience of selflessness. The incense is the same. As it consumes itself, it spreads its fragrance. Again, a symbol of selflessness. But what is interesting with the incense is that as it consumes itself and spreads its fragrance, it does not take control. It does not say, "Ooh, I don't like those over there. I am not going there. I'm going that way. Oh, no, they're much better looking or much nicer, whatever." The incense, the fragrance spreads everywhere, to everybody, no matter what. No discrimination. So then in awakening, that idea of no discrimination, of something which is widespread, which reaches out to everyone. And the third thing is the water. And water is the symbol first in reflection. The fact that if you have water, it reflects anything that comes above it. But again, it doesn't change, it doesn't last, it reflects totally what is in front of it, but it doesn't fit anything when the thing has moved. So the symbol of non-grasping, of totally total presentness without grasping. And at the same time, what is interesting with water is that it will adapt to every container it is put in. It becomes square, it becomes round, it becomes rectangular. So you know, in awakening, this notion of flexibility, adaptability, but also of flowing, of being fluid, of movement. Also, another way I find useful to look at awakening is the way the Buddha presented it. In the Zen tradition, they don't really, they are trained, they don't really talk about the four stages, the way the Buddha presented it. But when later on I read these four stages in a book on the Theravada Buddhism, I thought, wow, this is interesting. And I thought, ah, this is interesting. Because, you know, when we think of awakening, we think of gaining something. We think that if we awaken, we'll get something we don't have. When actually, if you look at the four stages of awakening, in each stage, something goes. So actually, awakening is not about gaining, it is about losing. And so, you know, what is it that we lose on this path of awakening? There is a first stage. And at the first stage, the Buddha said, three things go. Belief in self, belief in rites and rituals, and doubt. So you know, it's at that moment that Stephen was talking about this morning of, you know, cessation, when in a way we suddenly see very clearly that we are not an independent self, but that actually we are a flow of conditions interacting with other outer flow of conditions. So we get kind of a feeling about ourselves, which is much more fluid, with no movement, and a very fixed point of sight. That blue in the city itself grows, and instead you start to feel yourself not as a flaw of condition, but then a small feeling of a doubt with our condition. When Billy writes a literal book, so then we start to believe that salvation, liberation is in the rites and rituals themselves. The Buddha doesn't say that you cannot use them, but that they are not the end of the path. That they don't have, in a way, liberative power. And the third one is doubt. He said that at that moment, doubt disappears. Because we experience ourselves the possibility of a path. We have a glimpse of awakening, so to speak. And to me, in a way, this doubt is when we simply know for ourselves, this is what I'm doing. The meditative path, the spiritual path, is one of the foundations of my life. And I remember for myself, when I was in Korea, once I went to do a 3-month meditation in a small nunnery in the capital. And we were just a few nuns. And in the middle, it was winter, it's Korea, it's very cold, minus 10 degrees, snowy and everything. And there is a special ceremony where we have nuns to stand outside in the cold, and they sing with rice and ghosts and amulets. And so I do this for 3 hours, and I'm really buzzed. Because I think, ghosts, spirits, amulets, this is not what I'm becoming a nun. What's going on here? And I was very troubled. For 3 hours, I was really troubled. So, come on, And then there was great doubt, should I do this or not, And then I asked myself, but why do you want to? And I said, but I will be praying in order to assert myself, in order to develop wisdom and compassion. And I know it works. I have seen it for myself. And then I realized this thing, the spirit, the ghost, well, that was the kind of a religious story. I do not have to believe in it, I could help out, but I do not have to be involved in that kind of thing. But to me, this was really a shift, where I really decided, what is it I can trust? And in a way, all doubt left in terms of the meditation, were doubt in terms of the religious aspect, but this is another story. So this is the first thing. When we practice, and in a way, we have no doubt about our potential, and we have, in a way, no doubt by the fact that we can practice the path and realize it, like the Buddha has done it before. Then the second stage. In the second stage, greed and hatred are weakened. And to me, this is interesting. The Buddha is saying, greed and hatred are not easy to dissolve. They're really strong tendencies within ourselves. So there is a stage where they start to dissipate a little. They become a little weaker. And to me, this is actually about when the exaggeration goes. And I think all of us at times can experience that. When the exaggeration of what I want, the exaggeration about what I don't want, when it goes and you see the thing as it is. And I remember this moment when I was in Korea. I was doing a free season, so I was not doing the meditation. And I went to the bank, and I changed money. And the person at the bank gave me more money than I should have got. So my first inclination was, there for me, and once again, the capitalist system, I was an artist in my days, great. So in a way, exaggeration, great,
This is wonderful. Power. We always want more for nothing.
And then I stopped. And I said, no. I cannot do this. I cannot take this money. Because the poor is going to suffer. And so, you know, I stopped out of compassion. And you know, this is the thing, when the exaggeration of I want this, I can't stand this, disappears, then there is no space for compassion to see the other, to see the suffering that can happen to the other. And it is the same. When we often we think we don't like, we say, I cannot stand this. And so, you know, if we exaggerate the ugliness, or the darkness, or the negativity of it. So in a way we can't really deal with it as it is, because it is not so real in a way. And I had this funny experience. I was doing a retreat, and my job then was to be house cleaner. So my livelihood was to clean somebody's house. And so, in the middle of that retreat, I had to do my job, to get paid, etc. So I go down to the toilet and to the bathroom to clean it. And this was one of my greatest fears when I went to clean the toilet. Will there be something in it? No. And so in a way, I used to exaggerate the badness of whatever could be in the toilet bowl. And this time, I go in the room, I open it, and there is a big one. There is a big one. And I see, this is a form. And this is it, this is a form. It's still, I have to get rid of it, so still press the toilet. But to me, what was interesting, well, that there was not that exaggeration, which learned, stopping from really being able to handle whatever was there in a kind of appropriate manner. So I think at this stage, the Buddha is saying, there is a possibility of rooting greed and hatred by dissolving the exaggeration we put onto conditions. Then there is a third stage. And at the third stage, greed and hatred are dissolved totally. And this, I think, is more subtle, more basic. And this, of course, I think, is much more difficult. And I think we can work it very hard to have feelings of it. The person, I think, it's worth aspiring to it. I'm not sure if we'll get there, but I think it's worth trying it out. But I think there is this movement, I think within us, there is this movement of mind, body, heart, which is very immediate. I am for this, I am against that. And I think the best way to notice it is if there is a football match. This is my experience. Once I go down to my mother's living room and there is a football match on TV. So I just sit down within 5 minutes. I was for the blue, and I was against the red. I don't care about football. But it was, to me, fascinating how so quickly, very negative, I am for this, I am against that. But in a way, this is what the Buddha is saying. So we have to be trying to, in a way, work with. How can we encounter differently this tendency we have, I am for, I am against. And I think what we have to be careful when we say the dissolution of greed and hatred, it doesn't mean the dissolution of desire, the dissolution of liking this, disliking that. It doesn't mean the dissolution of a certain type of discrimination. I think we have to be careful. It is more saying that prejudice for against, and what generally comes out of that. And I think then it also helps us to look, what is it I want, and what is it I need? But I think in terms of our survival, we need food, we need medicine, we need clothes, we need houses. We need the four requisites, as the Buddha would say. And we cannot do without that. But now, do we fulfill our need in such a way that we trample another, that we cause suffering to others? Or do we think we need something when actually we want something that we don't really need? To me, this is interesting to reflect on this, not in terms of our experience, not some ideal state where there is no greed or hatred, but to look, what does it mean for me, greed and hatred? What does it mean for me in my experience to have less of it, to have an experience where there is less of it? What difference would it make? Because I think, as was mentioned this afternoon, of course, there is a basic biological survival. So the Buddha is not going against that. We do have to eat, we do need clothes and shelter and medicine. But it's kind of in a way moving from this 90% sort of greed and hatred for and against to maybe a more reasonable 50%. How can I make these organisms survive? How can I help other organisms to survive in a way which causes, in a way, the least suffering? To me, that's what this stage is about. You might say, what is left? And that's why I like these stages, because there's still lots of things left. And that, I think, is very something we can ponder. And at the first stage, conceit, restlessness, and ignorance go. So, what is interesting is that first stage, belief in self goes, but conceit is still there. Conceit, to say, I am this, I am that. But here it's seen in terms of identification. And one of the identifications we might have at this stage, I am enlightened. I mean, this is always, I can't, when I hear anybody say, I am enlightened, I think, wait a minute, but not at the first stage yet, you know? Because this is completely saying, I am this, I am that. And again, there is a slight kind of sticking to the condition. So we need to be careful. Because it's strange. People say, I am enlightened. And people believe that. I find that very interesting. We used to live in a town in England. And about once a year, somebody would say, I am enlightened. And then everybody would believe that. And it was kind of really weird thing. And it's fascinating. Fascinating to see. But in a way, maybe they have an experience. Maybe they have something useful to teach. But I think it's important to see. What is going on here? Because the Buddha, this is one thing, this is a Buddhist monk from now. That's one thing you would never say. I am enlightened. My teacher would never say, I had free awakening. Everybody said it, but he never said that. He would never say that. So, conceit, this I am this, I am that. Or restlessness, or just, you know, certain agitation, a certain excitement, that goes. Again, more contentment, more peace in the body and mind. And then ignorance goes. And ignorance is ignorance about the three characteristics. And to me, this is key. The fact that you hear a lot about this, we have mentioned them a lot, impermanence, dukkha, non-self. And you might think, but what's the point? What's the difference? What's the difference? If I really experience impermanence, what's the difference? If I really know dukkha, what's the difference? And to me, the key is compassion. I would say, if you really experience impermanence, dukkha, or non-self, naturally, wise compassion will arise. Let's take impermanence. Whichever nose has two aspects. One is death. This is the ultimate thing. Death. But we actually do not change as we're going to die. We live as we fall. Maybe in 20 years, maybe 20 years I'll die. So, I'm just thinking of my retirement plan, or whatever it is. Very interesting. You know, until we die, it happens to other people. This is the thing. So far as we say, no, not so. And then this makes us take life for granted. Ourselves for granted. Others for granted. And I remember when I saw my father die, I saw his last breath. And then I understood impermanence. And then there was this amazing compassion. And I started to look at everybody around me and to be aware that their life rested upon a single breath. Where they were precious, they were fragile. How can I have compassion for them? So this is very important, this point. And the second point about impermanence is change. And so this also is a big part of compassion. But actually, one of the most uncompassionate things we can do to ourselves or to others is to say, you will never change. And we say this when we say, you are always like this. I remember I learned to drive quite later. And I just, after I've been married with Stephen, finally I learned to drive in England, and I was a little nervous. And then I started to lock the key in the car. So I did it once, I did it twice, I did it a third time. And I told Stephen, I lock the key in the car, can you come? And he said, you always lock the key in the car. And I had this vision of me every day, every minute, every second, forever after, locking the key in the car. And this was a terrifying vision. And I thought, but no, I don't lock the key in the car all the time. And I thought, but when do I do it? And I realized it was when I had to park in a tight place. So after that, I got the key first. And then Stephen started to do it. So this is another story. So in a way, this is change, from us knowing the potential for change, arise compassion. If we can see someone, they might not change now, but we know there is the possibility that there can be some change at some point. So we don't fix them. We don't limit them. Or ourselves. Then there is dukkha. In dukkha, there is that idea of unreliability. So to me, to really experience that unreliability means that we stop fighting with things. And stop fighting if something doesn't work, we stop saying, it should not be this way. Why is not the company or whatever doing this? This was very interesting living in Korea, where it was, in those days it was very poor and things did not work all the time, and water did not work, or electricity did not work, the food was very poor, and it was very interesting because you stop assuming things should be this way. You accept it, they are unreliable, and you have a different relationship to them, much more creative, much more flowing. The same with unsatisfactoriness. There is no problem with contentment. And I think a lot of the meditation is about inner contentment. But often what we do is that we think something is going to give us lasting happiness. How then? A good job, a good partner, a good house, the right meditation technique, the right meditation teacher, whatever it is. We, I think, often are addicted to the hope that this is going to give it to us. But I know, as a writer,
when I got my first book. I was waiting every day I waited for that book to arrive, my first book. And then I thought, oh, this is going to give me at least some lasting happiness, this book. Finally, the book arrived at breakfast. I opened the package. See the cover, see the back, and this was it. No lasting happiness. I still had to eat my toast, I still had to go to the bathroom, I still had to deal with whatever difficulty. And to me, it was so interesting that moment. I put so much in it, which was not there. And so in a way, to find an inner contentment, it is very different. And I think through that we can do in life, I think in quite a different way than running after the satisfaction. But more important in dukkha, I feel, is to know the pain. Because it seems to me by really knowing pain, not inflicting it upon us, but knowing it, that it really compassion arrives. Because we know that suffering is painful, but also suffering is isolating. Nobody can experience my headache for me. Nobody can experience my pain for me. Somebody can be sympathetic, they can be empathic, but they cannot experience it themselves. So generally when we are in pain, we feel very isolated. And so, because of that, when we know that, then we have compassion for myself if I'm in pain or over when I'm in pain. Because I remember when I was young, I used to think, come on. I mean, I was 18, 30 years ago, and it was like, oh, it's all in the mind. You have pain. It's all in the mind. Get yourself together, you know. Think of your mind and you won't have any pain. I was very dismissive and not very compassionate to people. Then I got pain. In Korea, I got very bad stomach pain. And it was interesting. My first reaction was, why me? And I thought, oh, this is not bad. You mean somebody else is not very compassionate? And then I realized, this is a suffering that I was talking about. And in a way, I understood suffering in such a different way. That experiencing, knowing it myself, out of that arose compassion for others when they are in pain. And then there is non-self, which seems to trouble a few people now on. But let's not get too excited about this non-self. It only means that there is no independent existing self. This is all it means. It doesn't mean there is no self. It means there is a specific self does not exist. An independent self-existing self. Let me give a little example. I am sitting on this chair. Okay? Now, we talk about awareness. What about chairness? Where is the chairness of the chair? Is it in the light? Is it in the seat? Is it in the back? If I take the back off, I have a stool. If I take the leg off, I don't have much. The chair comes upon the part that constitutes it. There is no built, which is the whole chair. The chair just arrives upon this condition, and I can sit on it. This is all we are saying. Nothing else. We are not saying the chair does not exist. The chair is there. It's not going to disappear. We just say the chair comes upon the part that constitutes it. That's all. But why is this an important point to consider? If we want to consider it, you're not obliged to. But what do we do? Look at me. What is interesting without either a self or no self or whatever. So what do we do which causes difficulty? And generally, we see there is something here. A little cube. And only the three things. Okay. And everything I experience gets stuck. More. It's like a pin pressing, and the pin goes. And especially, we seem to have the pin of pain. You see, somebody said an accident, and then 3 years later, we tinker with the pin. Little blood, no, that was painful. That was painful. And another goes on. So we have all this. And actually, there is no pin pressing, and there is no pin to get stuck on it. And so in a way, the problem is the quality, even state, to something that is not really there in that way. An example, practical example. I am really tired. I've gone through a long walk. I am really tired. And there is this chair. And I sit on this chair and I think, oh, this is such a nice chair. A nice, good chair. But, another thing, I am really kind of busy, I am in a hurry, I need to get somewhere. The chair is in the way, and I fall. And I say, that's a bad chair. And I shouldn't pick it. So it's a bad chair. Because it's in the way. But the chair in itself is not good or bad. It's what I do with it. And in the same way, like when I used to live in England, every spring, because we have a garden, we used to have rhubarb. Do you know rhubarb? Okay, rhubarb in Hebrew. So you have an idea what it is, rhubarb. So it's a sort of vegetable fruit. It's like stalk, and it has a very definite taste. And every spring, for me, it's very sour, it's very acidic. And every spring, all the English, British people would say, great, river, pie, river, blah, blah, blah. And I used to say, oh, not good. Not good. And I used to think, what is the problem with that? Because the rhubarb is bad. If they like the rhubarb, there must be some badness within them. This is what we do. This is what we do. The French people, some French people, eat snail. And then you think, the snail are yucky. The French people eat the snail. They must be yucky. This is what we do. And this is why this idea of nonsense is about, really, is to see how we impute, how we fix ourselves, how we fix others. Instead of seeing, we are flows of condition. At that level, we are relatively stable. I think, again, change and no self doesn't mean there is not consistency. Tomorrow morning, I don't think that I will be an elephant. I should be relatively as I am. But if I have a stroke in the night, then yes, I could be quite different. But I still won't be an elephant. So there is a relative consistency. So within that, there is also some change. And we can all experience that. You look at yourself in the mirror, and you think, wow, I look great. And then you are really about this, and you look at yourself in the mirror, what is it? And then you think, not the same person. You see two different persons.
This is all what we're talking about. And then look, how can we relate to that? How can we, I think this helps us in a way not to fix so much. And again, to be able to be more open to ourselves and also open to others in that we don't fix them so much. And I have to stop here. But just last, just to see that this thing about awakening, to me these four stages, it might be so, it might not be so, I don't know. But what to me is interesting is that it shows me our multidimensionality. It shows me that there is lots of things to work upon, and I find this quite inspiring. But you know, there's always things to work on. But I don't have to solve them and achieve them right now, all at once. It's just at different times. I can look at different areas of my life with that spiritual eye, that creative attitude. Because you could have an alcoholic who feels he or she needs alcohol. And actually, I mean, they might think they need it, but it might not be good for them. So, no, this is a good point. I was, in that term, personally, I was thinking more in terms of maybe the consumer society, when, in a way, a lot of wants are created which are not really needed and can be quite dangerous in terms of ecology. But in terms of psychology, you know, I think you have a good point, to think for ourselves. Because I was thinking of wants in terms, maybe more, again, Buddhist, in terms of thirst. Some kind of like a thirst that can never be satiated. Or this kind of always wanting something. Well, actually, what I think you're talking about is more what I would call aspiration. You see, I want to be wise, I want to be compassionate. No, I'm at that level. You see, I think, in a way, it seems to me that here you're talking more about using need as a way to, in a way, fix the person. You know, you just need this, and you must take it, in a way. When I think you're talking of want as aspiring to something, and you aspire to something, then it opens up, it gives you energy. So I think, again, it's what the word means for us. And when I mentioned it, because I was thinking more in terms of that ecological way. But you have a very good point. I explained ignorance. Well, but I think Stephen answered that, because Stephen said that avidya, which is what goes as the fourth stage, is ignorance. And ignorance is ignorance about the three characteristics. When what Stephen was explaining was that moha, which is also often translated as confusion, is actually more the state when you feel neutral and then you feel bored, so to speak. You're kind of a little confused, a little muddled. So, in terms of the ratio, you see, the thing is, what one translates. I think Stephen, by translating avidya, you see, you can say delusion. Delusion is really translated as ignorance, and it's really part of all the three characteristics. And since I'm not a patent scholar, I can't really say. So in terms of confusion, yes, Stephen should address it. I was addressing it more in terms of avidya. What avidya was is what I described
of course, in my own way, about the three characteristics.
So this is a little bit of a technical question on the connection between the non-self of a person and, in a way, the emptiness of a chair, because you can't really talk about the non-self of the chair. And it is true, but when I use the example of the chair, it is more talking about emptiness. And when I talk about the non-self of the person, it's talking more about the non-self. But definitely, I would see these two things about different way to look at that idea, that notion, that things do not exist independently of the part that constitutes them. But of course, this is an explanation of emptiness. And generally, when Buddhists talk about non-self, it's always in connection with the five aggregates. But personally, I am not very keen in the five aggregates. They don't make much sense to me. So I am not there at the stage where I can talk about them meaningfully. And it seems to be more interesting to look in terms of flow of conditions and also to speak in terms of how we speak qualities onto ourselves and how we speak and what we do with it. But yes, good question. This I will come more to, if I may, when I'm going to talk about feelings. I'm going to talk about selfie, and I'm going to talk about love and feelings, possibly tomorrow. And then I will look into that, if I'm late for that one. And love, blah, blah, blah. What you present is a good question, because you very succinctly put actually the evolution of the idea of awakening in the Buddhist tradition. It has three phases. The first phase was thinking of enlightenment as the big enlightenment for the Buddha. After many, 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 many lifetimes, Buddha lifetime, and that's my problem with it, last lifetime, only in a male form, can you achieve full enlightenment. I have problem with sexual enlightenment myself, non-dual and all that, but we won't talk about this. So this is a presentation of the first one. Second phase, which is more like what I would call the Gelugpa Tibetan, is that enlightenment is like a seed, and if we water it, then within one lifetime we can become a Buddha, not the Buddha, so there is only the Buddha, blah, 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 in the male body, and so we can become a Buddha in one lifetime if we work hard at it. And then the third movement is a movement which is connected to the Avatamsaka Sutta that you find a lot in the Zen tradition, which is the fact, as the Avatamsaka Sutta says, that all sentient beings are Buddhas and all Buddhas are sentient beings. So that actually we are already Buddhas, but we don't see it. We don't know it because we are screened from it. And personally, I think in a way there is a place for these three different, in terms of the reincarnation and all that, then in a way you need, for the big one, you need the whole framework. But I think in terms of our experience, we can see that there is two elements to the past. One which is sudden, and you see something suddenly, which I think is back to the, you are awakened already. But there is also a gradual
cultivation. That we can also see, and that is the way our path is at the threshold of these two dimensions, the sudden aspect and the gradual aspect. That's the way I would, in a way, put them together. As to the Buddha being omniscient, perfect, and everything, well, the Dalai Lama said the Buddha was not a geographer, so I think it's a problem, possibly. Because to me, my problem with people who say they're enlightened is when they are not ethical. You see, this is my big problem with people who say they are the perfect guru, the perfect Lama, and then you hear they do all kinds of things with money, with sex, and alcohol, and everything of that nature. Then, personally, I feel I have a problem with this kind of... Anyway, but then they tell you it's all about crazy wisdom, but let's say I am not... Personally, I am not into crazy wisdom. That's not my thing. Okay. Oh, well, you don't want to know. You don't want to know. Crazy. I don't know anything about it. So as soon as I say the word. You see, I decided to become a nun over 3 days. Because someone in the monastery I passed through said to me, "You are young. You have nothing. I didn't have a family, I was not studying, I didn't have a job." She said, "God, where was you?" She was a 60-year-old Korean woman. "I would become a nun." And I said, "This is what I do. Why not? I can do meditation. Possibly I can also learn Tai Chi, calligraphy. What? Let's do this for a year or two." So, I become a nun. I never learned Tai Chi, never learned calligraphy, so I think I learned meditation. So, a year, 9 years later, my teacher, Master Kuzan, died. And things became very different in the monastery. The next master was not the same, he was not the same. He was not the same. And then I thought, before then, I would have passed over stopping being a nun. But after he died, and various other things, various other conditions arose, and I thought, no. I stopped. But the fact that I stopped becoming a nun, being a nun, didn't mean that I would stop the path, that I would stop the development of wisdom and compassion, but I would do it in a different way. That's what I am interested in, and that's what I can talk about. Me and ontology, we don't do much together. It's consciousness, free will, all these things, I don't eat them for breakfast.
So the way it functions
for you
is
simply that
necessary
to share. The share is today is wonderful tomorrow, and the share is wonderful today. There is room for change. But, and this is what I talk more about it when I talk about compassion in 2 days' time, that the change can be fast, and the change can be extremely slow. But what can I do myself to help the change? This is what I'm saying. I am not saying it is a miracle cure or magic wand, but that I myself have experienced change in myself. Definitely, that I can, I mean, they're not fantastically fast, but they have happened in different ways. And I've also seen change in people. I have also seen extremely slow change in people, but then still something can happen. But generally, one needs to have the conditions. Sometimes we can have the conditions, sometimes we cannot. Again, I'll talk more about that aspect. Maybe just one last one.
Okay. The role of the teacher in 2 minutes. We have to say that in Buddhism, there are 3 different types of teaching. There is a teacher as a guru, and you see the teacher as a Buddha himself, and you surrender. And personally, I think this is a little dangerous. And as a Dalai Lama said, if you're going to surrender to somebody, check them out for 5 years, that they're okay. And I think this is a very good advice. This is one model. Next model is what you find more in the Japanese Zen tradition, when the teacher is the master. And the master is always there to poke you and to kind of, you know, prod you and to kind of challenge you and kind of, you know, give you a hard time. And also it is quite Buddhistic in that, you know, you must stay with the teacher. You cannot change teacher in between. If you change teachers, very bad. Very bad. So again, some people like this, you know, where somebody is behind them saying, go, 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 you know, and kind of, you know, prod them. Some people like that. But again, it's a certain type of relationship. And there is a third type of relationship that you find generally in Korea, and you also find in Theravada country, which you see the teacher as a friend, a guide, a good knowing advisor, a kalalamita. And then the teacher is a guide. The teacher is not perfect. The teacher also is on the way. And the teacher knows something you might not know. And the teacher then try to share that with the disciple. And to me, it seems to be the healthier type, because you can go to any teacher. When I was in Korea, I read that, you know, the teacher would send people to each other. So, oh, no, you'll be better off with that one. Or go to that one. He could too. And you could go to anyone. It was wonderful. And so, in a way, I want us to see what is it I am looking. Because often there is this idea that the teacher, you know, if I find the teacher, the famous, the most enlightened teacher, then I don't have to do much, just sit there. But I experienced this when I was in college. I mean, as my teacher, I really respected him. He was not perfect, he had this kind of slight little thing, but he was very ethical, which was good for me. But he was really good. He was really wonderful person and very wise and really he was great. He was a great person. But once I was translating for a guest, an Australian, and he took with Master Kuzan. And Master Kuzan had no effort whatsoever on me. No, nothing. He said, he left, he said, who is this smack? Who is this smack? No, not interesting. Nothing, no effort whatsoever. And then Master Kuzan died, and the guy came by just after he just died, and we're all crying, and, you know, very distressed. I thought, what's the matter? He was just, you know, how did you die? Why are you upset about it? So he said, you could have the greatest teacher, and he could do nothing for you. And you could have somebody who is just, you know, and relatively ordinary person, but who has something that he or she can teach you. To me, this is what in a way is more important. Can I learn something from this person? Is it meaningful? Can I apply it? Can I practice it? Does it make a difference? And we will have to stop here. Thank you very much. And then we'll 15 minutes of walking before we sign off.